No, he will not forget us. With that confidence, Hudson Taylor and his small band of young missionaries were ready to evangelize inland China. The year 1866, 1867. Hudson Taylor's band of young missionaries was marked by the same faith and sense of spiritual urgency that sustained him. That same confident commitment to God and to the challenge before them was evident from the very start of their journey. It shone forth from the correspondence sent home and from the results of their work and their lives. For them, the simple theology of John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life, seemed motive enough to sacrifice their all. So the occasion of their leaving in May of 1866 deserved the tribute in verse penned by Hudson's missionary friend H. Grattan Guinness. Over the dark blue sea, over the trackless flood, a little band is gone in the service of their God. The lonely waste of waters they traverse to proclaim in the distant land of Sinem, Emmanuel's saving name. They have heard from the far-off east the voice of their brother's blood. A million a month in China are dying without God. No help have they but God. Alone to their Father's hand, they look for the supply of their wants in a distant land. The fullness of the world is his, all power in earth and heaven. They are strong though weak, and rich though poor in the promise that he has given. 'Tis enough they hear the cry, the voice of their brother's blood. A million a month in China are dying without God. The party of 16 missionaries, plus the Taylors, with their four young children, boarded the Lammermuir, a small sailing ship of less than 800 tons, for a scheduled four-month voyage around the globe. The first day on board, the group unpacked and got their cabins in order, but the second day, the work began. Hudson taught a Chinese language class every morning, then Maria taught another one in the afternoon. There were times at the beginning when all the students were down with seasickness. The teachers had to do double duty as steward and stewardess. But the younger people soon found their sea legs and proved to be good sailors. Life can get very trying in the cramped quarters of a small sailing ship. So it was for the crew to see how consistently these young missionaries practiced what they were going to preach in China. And while these rough sailors were none too happy being struck with a whole boatload of missionaries, they soon became appreciative of the group's friendliness, helpfulness, and even their penchant for hymn singing. Although the missionaries themselves had prayed beforehand for the opportunity to evangelize the crew, they refrained from pushing their beliefs until the sailors asked if the missionaries would begin holding services. As Hudson wrote to his friends, the Burgers, "We commenced by having service on Sunday morning in the saloon while with the captain's permission. A few of the sailors came. Then the young men started an afternoon meeting in the forecastle, held thrice weekly. Nor were our sisters less active. Mary Bell began a Bible class, which soon grew into a meeting for reading the scripture and for prayers every night. Mrs. Nichols and others joined her. Some were converted, and these meetings became general. Mrs. Desgrais undertook reading with the four Swedes, Mrs. Faulding with the German, Mrs. Balsman with the cook and the South Sea Islander. Mrs. Barnes held a reading class for all who wished to improve themselves in English and has been blessed with the conversion of several. Eventually, a majority of the crew accepted Christ. One of the last was the first mate, Mr. Brunton, who had been a savage bully among the men. His sudden and complete change of heart and lifestyle was the cause of much excitement and rejoicing among the missionaries. After a long, hard voyage across the Atlantic, through the treacherous waters at the tip of South America, and then over the vast stretches of the South Pacific, the Lammermuir sailed safely. It wasn't until they reached the China Sea that the ship faced its greatest test. For 12 straight days, the ship was battered by one typhoon after another. Many among the crew were sick. The structure of the ship was weakened. On Tuesday, September 18th, they finally sighted the China coast, only to be hit by the worst weather yet. They encountered still another typhoon which drove the severely crippled ship away from their destination. The captain did all he could just to keep his ship afloat. Hudson described the experience by writing, "Friday, September 21, the gale increasing and having all the appearance of another typhoon. We had prayed together from time to time during the afternoon and night. The decks were swept by the sea in a manner I have never before witnessed. Saturday, September 22. The jibs and staysails gave way early this morning. So fearful was the sea that the men refused to go out and to secure them. The captain and first mate went on to the forecastle. The men followed. But soon all had to be recalled as the vessel was driven into the sea. Soon after this, the lee, the upper bulwarks, began to give way. And before long, all this side was overboard. Next, the jib boom and the flying jib boom gave way, following immediately by the foretop and the top gallant masts and the main top gallant mast. They hung by the wire shrouds, swinging almost fearfully, owing to the heavy rolling of the sea. The appearance of things was now truly terrific. The decks were full of water, which poured over both sides as she rolled, were encumbered by floating spars, tubs, buckets, casks, etc. Because the danger of being washed aboard, there was no small risk of having one's limbs broken by moving timbers torn from their moorings. Praying to God was our only resource. The sailors, paralyzed, gave up work. The probability seemed that our hours, if not minutes, were numbered. I kissed the dear children, and with the young men went out and set to work, hoping to encourage others. Hudson downplayed his own role in the ship's survival, but another missionary, W.D. Rudland, wrote, "All through the storm, Mr. Taylor was perfectly calm. When almost at its height, the men refused to work any longer. The captain had advised all to put on life belts. 'She can scarcely hold for another 2 hours,' was his verdict." At this injuncture, he was going to the forecastle, where the men were taking refuge, revolver in hand. Mr. Taylor went up to him. "Don't use force," he said, "till everything else has been tried." He then went in quietly and talked to the men, telling them he believed God would bring us through, but that everything depended upon the greatest care in navigating the ship, in other words, upon the men themselves. "We will all help," he added. "Our lives are in jeopardy as much as yours." The men were completely reassured by his quiet demeanor and friendly reasoning, and with officers, midshipmen, and the rest of us, went to work in earnest at the wreckage, and before long got in the great iron spars that were ramaging the side of the ship. Somehow the ship stayed afloat. The women as well as the men took turns on Sunday working the pumps to keep her that way. It wasn't until Monday that the weather finally cleared, but the danger wasn't over. The pumps had quit, and the ship was taking on water fast. Yet through the ordeal, Maria Taylor, confined to her storm-tossed cabin with four young children, remained confident in God's steadfast grace. She later wrote, "It was sweet to rejoice in God through all, to rest in past proofs of his love, independently of present circumstances, and I entered into Habakkuk's song as never before. Quote, yet will I rejoice in the Lord, I will glory in the God of my salvation." End quote. It wasn't until Sunday, September 29th, that the Lammermuir limped into sheltered waters and anchored just offshore from the foreign settlement of Shanghai. Curious sightseers gathered to see the mangled, broken vessel that carried the largest single contingent of missionaries ever to arrive in China. But Hudson kept his worn-out band aboard for the night, where the group held a praise service to thank God for his protection. Another ship, landing right after theirs, reported the loss of 16 out of a ship's company of 22. Yet no one aboard the Lammermuir was even seriously injured. Despite his gratitude for the safe journey, as he looked once again upon the city of Shanghai, Hudson must have felt that the real challenge was just beginning. None of the missionaries he knew there would be able to house a party of 20 people, and remembering how hard it had been to find accommodations just for himself the first time he arrived in China, he had to feel a great and sudden sense of responsibility for the young, idealistic missionaries he brought with him. None of them knew what to expect when they stepped ashore in China for the first time, but Hudson knew all too well. But just as prayers had been answered in the midst of the storm, they were also answered in Shanghai. A missionary acquaintance of Hudson's from Ningpo happened to have purchased a residence with an empty warehouse attached. He had not only offered Hudson and his party the warehouse for temporary housing, he also told them that they could store their extra printing, medical, and other supplies there while they journeyed inland. So it was only 2 days after the Lammermuir sailed into Shanghai that the entire mission party was housed and a temporary headquarters was established. The group of missionaries caused a bit of stir in the foreign settlement. Some Europeans, seemed scandalized to learn that Hudson had brought ladies to China with the plan to send them into the unknown interior, and in Chinese dress, no less, some wondered if Hudson was some sort of a madman. It was indeed an unprecedented and bold venture. The Taylors had in their company a total of 6 unmarried women, and at that time, in all of China, there were only 17 single women missionaries, and not one was to be found outside the 5 treaty ports. Hudson ignored the criticism, saying, "We have and may expect to have some trials, but the Lord is with us." As to the criticism about his requirement that everyone associated with his mission should adopt Chinese fashion, Hudson remained convinced that it was the only way to carry out an effective ministry in the interior. Not only had his own experience proved that the strategy would reduce undue notice during travels into new territory, but he felt strongly that it would help reduce one more barrier to effective cross-cultural communication. Evidence of just how visionary his thinking was on this subject can be seen in what he wrote to candidates in the first stages of applying to go out under the China Inland Mission. He wrote, "I am not alone in the opinion that foreign dress and carriage of missionaries, the foreign appearance of chapels, and indeed the foreign air imparted to everything connected with their work, has seriously hindered the rapid dissemination of the truth among the Chinese. And why should such a foreign aspect even be given to Christianity? The Word of God does not require it, nor, I conceive, could sound reason justify it. It is not the denationalization, but the Christianization of this people that we seek. We wish to see Chinese Christians raised up, men and women, true Christians, but withal truly Chinese in every sense of the word. We wish to see churches of such believers presided over by pastors and officers of their own countrymen, worshiping God in the land of their fathers, in their own tongue, and in edifices of a thoroughly native style of architecture. If we really wish to see the Chinese such as we have described, let us, as far as possible, set before them a true example. Let us in everything not sinful become Chinese, that we may by all means save some. Let us adopt their dress, acquire their language, seek to conform to their habits, and approximate to their diet as far as health and constitution will allow. Let us live in their houses, making no unnecessary alteration in external form, and only so far modifying their internal arrangements as health and efficiency for work absolutely require. This cannot but involve, of course, a certain measure of inconvenience, such as the sacrifice of some accustomed articles of diet. But will anyone, reflecting on what he gave up, who left heaven's throne to be cradled in a manger, who, having filled all things and wielded omnipotence, became a feeble infant wrapped in swaddling clothes, who, from being the loved one of the Father, never misjudged, never unappreciated, and receiving the ceaseless adoration of all the hierarchies of heaven, became a despised Nazarene, misunderstood by his most faithful followers, neglected and rejected by men who owed him their very being and whose salvation he had come to seek, and finally mocked, spit upon, crucified, and slain with thieves and outlaws, will any follower of Christ, reflecting on these things, hesitate to make the trifling sacrifices indicated above?" It was a sacrifice, and no one knew it better than Maria Taylor. She wrote her friend, Mrs. Berger, "Things which are tolerated in us as foreigners, wearing foreign dress, could not be allowed for a moment in native ladies. I do not at all mean to imply a doubt as to the desirability of the change, but the nearer we come to the Chinese in outward appearance, the more severely will any breach of propriety, according to their standards, be criticized. Henceforth, I must never be guilty, for example, of taking my husband's arm out of doors. And in 50 or 100 other ways, we may, without great watchfulness, shock the Chinese by what would seem to them grossly immodest and unfeminine conduct. Oh, pray much for us in respect to this matter." Maria Taylor, too, had a cross-cultural sensitivity far ahead of her time. Just 3 weeks after their arrival in Shanghai, the entire party boarded houseboats to travel together into the interior, heading up the Grand Canal toward Hangzhou in search of a permanent inland headquarters for the mission. Traveling by houseboats made it possible for the women and children to be sheltered from curious crowds as they passed city after city. Everywhere they stopped, Hudson inquired about permission to rent or buy accommodations where some of the young men in his party might settle. But at each stop, he was refused permission from local authorities. No suitable place was available. The landlord wouldn't come to terms, or some other complication thwarted his original plan. So, the full contingent of missionaries, some 20 strong, remained together as the boats finally approached the great city of Hangzhou. The Taylors knew that two or three mission families had already taken up residence in that city, and it would mean serious risk to them as well as to the new arrivals if such a large party of foreigners stirred up opposition. But what else could they do? It was autumn. Winter was fast approaching. The nights on the water was already bitterly cold, and several of the party were ill, and the boat people were clamoring to go home for the winter. Never had the responsibilities of leadership weighed so heavily on him as it did when Hudson left the boats in a quiet place outside the city and went ahead to inquire about the accommodation they so desperately needed. Maria also felt the seriousness of the situation, so after Hudson left, she gathered the younger missionaries for prayer, telling them of the comfort that had come to her through the psalm in her regular reading that morning. Quote, "Who will bring me into this strong city? Who will lead me into Eden? Wilt not thou, O God, give us help from trouble? For vain is the help of man." End quote. Together they read that passage again as they waited anxiously for word. Suddenly, Hudson was back. Wonderful news! A home was ready, waiting for them. One of the Hangzhou missionaries was absent for a week and had left word that his house, comfortably furnished, was at the disposal of Mr. Taylor's party. Situated on a quiet street, it could be reached in the boats unobserved. And that very night, the weary, thankful travelers were at rest in the great city. Within the next few days, in spite of all the usual difficulties, Hudson secured premises of his own, a large rambling house which had once belonged to a government official, that had over time become a warren, occupied by a number of families. There was plenty of room to adapt to the needs of the mission party. A number of renters and their families stayed on for a while, making it possible for the group to begin missionary work within their own doors, without attracting too much attention. From the very start, Jenny Faudling, the youngest of the party, was already able to make herself understood by the Chinese women. Hudson wrote in a report to his friends and supporters back in England at the 1st of December, "It is pretty cold weather to be living in a house without any ceilings and with very few walls and windows. There is a deficiency in the wall of my own bedroom, 6 feet by 9, closed in with a sheet so that ventilation is decidedly free. But we heed these things very little. Around us are poor, heathen, large cities without any missionary, populous towns without any missionary, villages without number, all destitute of the means of grace. I do not envy the state of mind that would forget these, or leave them to perish, for fear of a little discomfort." By mid-December, Jenny Faudling wrote home, "We have been getting the house a little more comfortable, though there is plenty still to be done. Mr. Taylor and the young men have contrived paper ceilings fixed on wooden frames, which keep out some of the cold air, for the upstairs rooms have roofs such as you find in chapels at home. They also have prepared some of the partitions between the rooms. Of course, we are as yet in confusion, but we're getting on, and I hope shall be settled some day. The lodgers are to leave next week. They occupy principally the ground floor. I'm so glad for them to have been here, for many have come to Chinese prayer meetings and listened attentively. We could not have visited out of doors yet, but I read and talk with those women every day, and they seem to like it. One woman I have great hope for." Before Christmas, they were interested audiences of 50 or 60 at the Sunday services, and Hudson had been at least on one evangelistic journey. In the neighboring city of Zhaozhan, he and James Meadows had found excellent opportunities for preaching the gospel and had been able to rent a small house. They planned to settle some of the new arrivals there just as soon as possible. Right away, Hudson wrote Mr. Berger at the home office. You will be glad to learn that facilities for sending letters by native post and for transmitting money to the interior are very good. I do not think that there will be any difficulty in remitting money to any province in the empire, which will not be easily overcome. In the same way, letters from the most distant parts can be sent to the ports. Such communication is slow and may prove rather expensive, but it is tolerably sure. Thus, we see the way opening before us for work in the interior. The team had barely established its first base in the interior, and Hudson was already planning the next steps of sending missionaries farther inland. But in the meantime, his hands were more than full at Hung Zhao. After the Chinese New Year, patients crowded into the dispensary, as many as 200 a day, and an equal number attended the Sunday services. When the first reinforcements arrived from home early in 1867, Hudson was literally too busy to even greet them until hours later. He was standing on a table at the time, preaching to a crowd of patients in the courtyard, and could only call out a hearty welcome as the newest party entered, escorted by James Meadows. The busyness didn't seem to bother the new arrivals. They were more than happy to work side by side with the leader they so respected. John McCarthy, who became Hudson's chief medical assistant, later wrote of this time, "I think of him as I ever knew him, kind, loving, thoughtful of everyone but himself, a blessing wherever he went, and a strength and comfort to all with whom he came in contact, a constant example of all that a missionary ought to be." Yet there was some dissension in the ranks. One critical couple of the Chinese dress policy stirred up complaints about Hudson's leadership from two or three others as well. But Hudson and Maria, too, determined to respond with patience and love. Though the handful of dissenters sent their complaints about the tailors' leadership back to England, neither Hudson nor Maria felt it necessary to defend themselves. Not until months later did Maria mention the matter, even in writing Mrs. Berger, and then it was in answer to inquiries from St. Hill that she even wrote at length. "Do pray for us very much, for we do so need God's preserving grace at this present time. We've come to fight Satan in his very strongholds, and he will not let us alone. What folly were ours! Were we here in our own strength? But greater is he that is in us than all that are against us. I should be very sorry to see discord sown among the sisters of our party, and this is one of the evils I'm fearing now. What turn the in," and then she underlines it so that we won't really know the name, "what turn the in matter will take, I cannot think. One thing I know, the hope of Israel will not forsake us. One is almost tempted to ask, why was in permitted to come out? Perhaps it was that our mission might be thoroughly established on a right basis early in its history." Hudson and Maria were both deeply saddened by the conflict within the mission, yet the response in Hung Zhao continued to be very encouraging. So, when the first baptisms came in May, Mrs. Taylor wrote again to Mrs. Berger, "Perhaps the dear Lord sees that we need sorrows to keep us from being elated at the rich blessing he's giving in our work." By that time, the mission had established additional outposts, and the administrative details had multiplied. As Jenny Faulding wrote, "If only Mr. Taylor could be in three or four places at the same time, it would be a decided advantage. He's wanting to visit the governing cities of the province, to look out for the most eligible places for stations. He and Mr. Duncan have been on the point of starting several times. Then there is Ningpo, where he is needed, and here he is overwhelmed with work. He wants to go to Zhao Hin, to Mr. Stevens' stations, that he may give further help with the colloquial dialect. There is hardly any knowing what his movements may be. Yet he goes on so quietly and calmly always, just leaning upon God and living for others. That is a blessing merely to witness his life." The greatest sacrifice he had to make, Hudson felt, was leaving his family behind whenever he had to depart on the journey. He loved his children and enjoyed all the time he could spend with them, including the daughter who was born that first winter in Hung Zhao. But his little 8-year-old daughter, Grace, seemed a particular blessing. During the voyage to China on the Lemurmur, she was so impressed by the changes she saw in the sailors who accepted Christ that she made her own personal commitment to the Lord. After that, despite her tender age, she seemed as devoted to the task in China as her parents. Early in 1867, she sent a note along with her father when he left on a short journey. Written on pink notepaper with a flower painted in one corner were the words, "Dear Papa, I hope God has helped you to do what you wanted and that you will soon come back. I have a nice bed mat for you when you come home. Dear, dear Papa." As the summer malaria season set in and temperatures rose to 103 degrees Fahrenheit indoors, Hudson took Maria, who was getting sick, and his five children out to Hangzhou to some nearby wooded hills where they rented a cooler summer shelter in the ruins of an old temple. As they left their boats that first day and walked up the hill toward the temple, little Grace noticed a man making an idol.
"Oh, Papa," she said earnestly, "he doesn't know about Jesus, or he would never do that. Won't you tell him?"
His daughter's hand clasped in his, Hudson did so. Afterwards, they walked on, and when they stopped to rest, Gracie wanted to pray for the man that they had met. Hudson wrote, "Never have I heard such a prayer. She had seen the man making an idol. Her heart was full, and she was talking to God on his behalf. The dear child went on and on, pleading that God would have mercy upon the poor Chinese and would strengthen her father to preach to them. I never was so moved by any prayer. My heart was bowed before God. Words fail me to describe it." Just a week later, a broken-hearted Hudson Taylor wrote to his friend, Mr. Berger, "Beloved brother, I know not how to write or how to refrain. I'm trying to pen a few lines by the couch on which my darling little Gracie lies dying. Her complaint is hydrocephalus. It was no vain nor unintelligent act when, knowing this land, its people, and climate, I laid my wife and children with myself on the altar for this service. And he, whom so unworthily, yet in simplicity and godly sincerity, we are, and have been seeking to serve, and with some measure of success, he has not left us now." But to his mother, Hudson poured out his anguish. "Our dear little Gracie, how we miss her sweet voice in the morning, one of the first sounds to greet us when we awoke, and through the day, and at eventide. As I take the walks I used to take with her tripping figure at my side, the thought comes anew like a throb of agony. Is it possible that I shall never more feel the pressure of that little hand, never more see the sparkle of those bright eyes? And yet she's not lost. I would not have her back again. I'm thankful she was taken, rather than any of the others, though she was the sunshine of our lives. But she is far holier, far happier than she could have ever been here. I think I never saw anything so perfect, so beautiful as the remains of that dear child. The long, silken eyelashes under the finely arched brows, the nose so delicately chiseled, the mouth small and sweetly expressive, the purity of the white feature, all are deeply impressed on heart and memory. And then her sweet little Chinese jacket, and the little hands folded on her bosom, holding a single flower. Oh, it was passing fair, and so hard to close forever from our sight. Pray for us. At times I seem almost overwhelmed. But he has said, 'I will never leave thee nor forsake thee,' and 'My strength is made perfect in weakness.' So be it." 1867-68. In a letter to his family in England, Hudson wrote that the only thing that kept his mind off his grief was the work he did with Maria. And they did work. Perhaps in determination not to let their daughter's death be for nothing, they devoted themselves anew to the task of reaching inland China with the gospel. Before the close of 1867, little more than a year after the band of inexperienced missionaries had arrived in Shanghai, all the prefectural governing cities in Gaicheng had been visited. Nanking finally had been reached by a missionary, and the members of the mission were working in centers as much as 24 days' journey apart. The church in Hangzhou was well established with Wang Lei-jung, Hudson's Chinese helper, who had gone back to England with him as its pastor. And by the spring of 1868, it looked possible for the Taylors to be spared from that center to help in expanding the work on some newer frontier.
In those days, opening any new mission station in China included the risk of death itself. Riots occurred so often that they became almost an accepted part of existence. So it seemed a natural and necessary question for Hudson to ask one missionary candidate who had only one leg and could walk only with the help of a crutch. "But what would you do in China if a riot broke out and you had to run away?" "I had not considered running away," the man answered quietly, and citing scripture added confidently, "I thought that the lame were to take the prey." And in fact, after the man was accepted by the mission and helped open a new station in Wanzhou, that confidence was tested. "Why don't you run away?" yelled the rioters who were robbing him of everything he had and had even taken away his crutches. "Run away?" he replied with a smile. "How can a man run with only one leg, I should like to know?" Disarmed by his courage and friendliness, the rioters stopped their rampage, and calm was restored. The same spirit of confident faith marked George Duncan, the tall, quiet Highlander who had made his way to Nanking as the first resident missionary there. The people of that city, which had felt the brunt of war as the old Taiping capital, remained so wary of any foreign interest that city officials sent word to all the innkeepers that the foreigner was not to be given any lodging. Fortunately, the priest in charge of the city, Drum Tower, hadn't been warned, probably because no one considered him a possible host. Indeed, he had no proper room for visitors. But when a weary and discouraged George Duncan inquired, the man told him that he could stay in the tower at night if he wished, as long as he was out during the day, so as not to frighten the people who came to the tower to worship. "It proved a particular miserable place to live," wrote Duncan. "We gladly accepted it, and managed very nicely, though we have rather more rats than I like. At night they want to devour everything." Between the constant scurrying of the rodents and the regular solemn sounding of the drums, the missionary didn't get much sleep. And at dawn he had to roll up his bedding and turn out on the streets to spend the day in tea shops and the marketplace, sharing the gospel as best he could while trying to learn the local dialect. "I'm not able to talk much," he wrote. "But God helping me, I will say what I can." Eventually, a local carpenter risked renting the foreigner a portion of an upstairs room where his own Chinese family lived. And not long after that, Duncan convinced the carpenter to rent a portion of a street-level room, which he partitioned off as a narrow little chapel, the first Christian church in Nanking. Soon after his arrival in Nanking, George Duncan had sent Hudson the names of two banks that had representatives back in Hangzhou. When one bank failed and the other left the city, there was no longer any channel for headquarters to provide him with the funds he needed to live and carry on his work. Duncan didn't worry. Even when he had to change his last piece of silver and his Chinese cash quickly disappeared. But his Chinese cook and assistant became very concerned. "What shall we do when the money is all gone?" he asked. "Do?" the missionary responded. "Why, we shall trust in the Lord and do good. So shall we dwell in the land, and verily we shall be fed." Days went on, and still Hudson was unable to reach Nanking by native banks. Finally, in his anxiety for Duncan, he sent a brother missionary, W.D. Rudlin, up the canal by boat with money for the work in Nanking. But the water level had dropped so far by the time he sailed to a point that was still at least a week away from Nanking by canal, that Rudlin abandoned the boat and headed cross-country for a shorter, but more strenuous, 4-day, 60-mile walk to the city. By this time, the cook's savings, willingly given to the work, had been completely used up. Duncan had not a dollar left, but he went out that morning to preach as usual, reminding his anxious companion, "Let us just trust in the Lord and do good. His promise is still the same. So shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily shalt thou be fed." That evening, W.D. Rudlin understood why the water in the Grand Canal had run so low. His overland hike brought him to Nanking several days earlier than would have been possible by boat. And when he reached his colleague's house, he found Duncan's cupboards as empty as his bank account. When Duncan returned tired and hungry from preaching all day, his Chinese helper went running to meet him. "Oh, sir," he cried breathlessly, "it's all right, it's all right. Mr. Rudlin, the money, a good supper." "Did I not tell you this morning?" Duncan replied, laying a kindly hand on the man's shoulder. "It is always all right to trust in the living God." Now, Hudson wasn't content to leave the challenges of pioneer missionary work to younger men like George Duncan. He and Maria readily faced as many dangers and hardships as any one of those who worked for the China Inland Mission. After only 16 months of settled life in Hangzhou, the church there already numbered 50 baptized believers. But with Wang Lijun as pastor and John McCarthy and Jenny Faudling assisting him there, the Taylors knew that the work was in good hands. So when spring came, Hudson and Maria packed up, loaded their household and four children aboard a junk, and set out by canal, intending to join Duncan in Nanking or to establish another station in any city that might open up to them en route. After the untimely death of their 8-year-old daughter, Gracie, in 1867, Hudson Taylor and his wife, Maria, dedicated themselves even more completely to the work in China. Outposts were being established. Many were hearing the message of Jesus for the first time. All were encouraged. After living so long inside the city walls, the freedom and freshness of the countryside provided a welcome and beautiful change of pace. Great mulberry plantations bordered the canal, with plum, peach, and apricot orchards blooming like some great bridal bouquet. Wheat and barley covered the lush valleys, which were interspersed with great fields of peas and beans in full flower. The canal itself, alive with boat traffic, fascinated the children just as the scenic beauty of its shores refreshed their parents. For 3 weeks, they traveled with Mr. Henry Gordon, one of their young missionaries who was just beginning his own new work in the famous city of Suzhaofu, before their junk reached Tianjin, at the junction of the Grand Canal and the mighty Yangtze River. So impressed was Hudson by the city and its strategic location that he determined to establish a mission station there. He began negotiations for property, which the missions eventually acquired, but since the final details of the negotiations looked as if they would drag on for some weeks, the Taylors continued their journey up the northern segment of the canal. So after 2 months of boat life, the Taylor family reached the great city of Yangtze, the city Marco Polo once governed. Its ancient turreted walls enclosed a population of 360,000 without even one missionary. Here again, Hudson felt so burdened by the spiritual needs he saw that he decided to try to settle his family in Yangtze. After their arrival there, Maria wrote Mrs. Berger, "Were it not that you yourselves are old travelers, I should think it impossible for you to realize our feelings last Monday week, when we exchanged the discomfort of a boat, into every room of which the heavy rain had been leaking, for a suite of apartments in a first-rate Chinese hotel, such a place as my husband, who has seen a good deal of Chinese travelers' accommodations, never before met with, and that hotel, too, inside the city of Yangtze." The reception by a friendly innkeeper and crowds of interested visitors greatly raised the Taylors' hopes for the promise of an effective new mission station in that great city. And when a favorable proclamation came from the governor on their behalf, they soon acquired a house into which the family moved in the middle of July. The summer heat was already trying, and they hoped for quieter days in August. But the rush of patients and visitors continued. A foreign family seemed quite an attraction, especially as Hudson proved to be such a skillful physician. Maria also established her own reputation among the women who were charmed by her pleasing Chinese speech and manners. Before long, just as had happened in Hangzhou, hearts began opening to the gospel, and the presence of a mother and children helped diffuse most suspicion. But their successes didn't come without trials or opposition. The children all contracted measles, and the Taylor's youngest son developed a life-threatening case of bronchitis as a complication. Hudson himself grew so ill that for some time he wasn't at all sure he would survive. During the summer, some of the city's literati held a meeting and decided to stir up trouble. Anonymous handbills appeared all over the city, attributing the most revolting crimes to foreigners, especially those whose business it was to propagate the religion of Jesus. Before long, the missionaries witnessed the changing attitude of the people. Friendly visitors gave way to crowds of disorderly rabble who congregated outside the Taylors' home, shouting insults at the missionaries. A fresh set of posters added fuel to the flame. Time after time, rioting was prevented only by the kind, patient words of a sick and very weakened Hudson Taylor, who stood in the doorway of his home, quietly answering all accusations and reassuring an angry mob that they intended no harm. Finally, the intense heat of August was broken by torrential rains, which effectively scattered the crowds, and the Taylors felt doubly relieved and heartened when the Rudlands and George Duncan arrived to help them. However, the relief was short-lived. Two foreigners from Jingcheng, Europeans in foreign clothing, came up to visit Yangzhou, causing quite a stir through the city. And those opposing the Taylors saw too good a chance to pass up. No sooner had the visitors left and everything returned to normal again that the literati became circulating the rumor that children all over the area were reported missing. The story was that 44 children had been kidnapped by the inhuman foreigners. Everywhere the troublemakers were saying, "Let's avenge our wrongs! Attack! Destroy the foreigners! Much loot shall be ours!" As a mob, intent on destruction, gathered outside the mission house, Hudson and George Duncan slipped away under cover of darkness and raced toward the governor's palace for help. As Hudson described it, "But for the protection afforded us by the darkness, we should scarcely have reached the Ya men, the police, alive. Alarmed by the yells of the people, the gatekeepers were just closing the doors as we approached, but the momentary delay gave time for the crowd to close in upon us. The as-yet unbarred gates gave way to the pressure, and we were precipitated into the entrance of the hall. Had the gates been barred, I'm convinced that they would not have been opened for us, and we should have been torn to pieces by the enraged mob." Inside the governor's residence, Hudson and his friend were kept anxiously awaiting. In the distance, they could hear the sounds of a riot, where they'd left the other missionaries and Maria and the children at the mercy of a mob that had already swelled to 8,000 to 10,000. Finally, the governor came out. Hudson pleaded for his help in calming the crowd and restoring order, and the official responded by calling out 3,000 troops who soon dispersed the crowds. Still, fearful for the safety of the others, Hudson and George hurried back to the mission. Hudson wrote, "We returned under escort. On the way back, we were told that all the foreigners we had left were killed. We had to cry to God to support us, though we hoped this might prove exaggerated or untrue." When we reached the house, the scene was such as baffled description. Here, a pile of half-burned reeds showed where one of the attempts to fire the premises had been made. There, debris of a broken-down wall was lying. And strewn about everywhere were the remains of boxes and furniture, scattered papers and letters, broken work boxes, writing desks, dressing cases, and surgical instrument cases, smoldering remains of valuable books, but no trace of inhabitants within. An agonizing search revealed that the missionaries and the children were hiding at a neighbor's house. After the rioters had broken in and begun burning the building, they had all escaped onto a roof and jumped to the ground in the darkness. Some had been injured. One young missionary had received a serious head wound from a rock. Maria had injured her leg leaping from the roof, and others had various cuts and bruises. But they were all alive, and they were just as grateful to be found by Hudson as he was to find them. As miraculous as their survival had been, Hudson decided not to take unnecessary chances. He loaded everyone on a junk and headed down the canal until passions cooled in Yangzhou. Only 48 hours after the riot, as their boat neared Qingyang, Maria wrote in a letter, "Our God has brought us through. May it be to live henceforth more fully to His praise and glory. We have had another typhoon, so to speak, not as prolonged as the literal one nearly 2 years ago, but at least equally dangerous to our lives and more terrible while it lasted."
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com. by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart, from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle is adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.